You are listening to the 2014 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust Leadership Conference, Word Made Flesh, Leadership in a Modern World. In this dinner keynote, Michael Lindsay offers a talk entitled Christian Faithfulness and Public Leadership.
Well, it's really great to have a chance to share with you some of the sort of key things that I learned. I've entitled this Christian Faithfulness and Public Leadership, and what are some of the key things that I learned over the course of the 10 years while I was working on this project. One of the key lessons that I learned is the importance of thinking institutionally but acting personally. I've been deeply influenced by a political scientist named Hugh Hecklow, who wrote a wonderful little book called On Thinking Institutionally. And it doesn't mean thinking about institutions. It means a different paradigm in which you approach information. One of the interesting things is that when you're in an institutional context is that you can sort of lose the personal component. I close the book with a story of Mike Ullman. Mike is probably the most impressive leader I interviewed of all 550. The reason that Mike stands out to me in so many different ways, for one, he demonstrated leadership capability very early on. He was chosen to be the chief financial officer at the University of Cincinnati, an institution of 40,000 students, at age 29. He got that job from Warren Bennis, who was the president of the University of Cincinnati, who saw in Mike tremendous leadership talent. He then went on to do a variety of different things and has really become the world's leading retail guru. So he's the only person that I know who has been the CEO on three continents of three different major retail enterprises. He was the CEO of Macy's and led them through their bankruptcy restructuring in the early 90s. He was the CEO of Duty Free Shops, DFS, based out of Hong Kong. You know all the duty free shops you see in the airports? That's Mike's idea. And he created that based out of Hong Kong. And also, on the side, he ran the port of Hong Kong. And then he was chosen by Bernard Arnault to be the CEO of Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy, LVMH, which is the conglomerate that owns every luxury good you could possibly imagine. Then he was chosen by Vernon Jordan, who was chairman of the board, to come and be the CEO of JCPenney. He did that job for 7 years, taking JCPenney from being pretty close to the brink of bankruptcy to, at the time that he retired in 2011, two out of five American families were doing business with JCPenney every year. Their employee engagement scores at JCPenney were higher than that at Starbucks, and their customer service scores were higher than that of Nordstrom's. He had been involved in helping to recruit his successor, who was a good guy who came out of Apple, created the retail business for Apple, but he was sort of a square peg in a round hole at JCPenney. He introduced a new, different business model for JCPenney. In the process, he was not successful in recruiting any new customers to the company, and he alienated all of their existing customers. They lost $1 billion in a matter of 11 months. And in the end, the company said, we cannot deal with this. And so the board replaced him. And now they find themselves, what are we going to do? I mean, we are in a financial free fall. And they did what is unheard of in Fortune 500 companies. They called Mike and said, would you come back and serve? And it was interesting because I went to go interview Mike or visit Mike in his office. I'd interviewed him a couple of times because he just was so impressive. And I was in his office about 2 weeks after he'd been reinstated. This happened in April of 2013. So he's been on the job now for about 16 months. And it appears that JCPenney will, in fact, actually recover before the end of this calendar year. And his office suite is very far from the main reception area. And so his assistant was walking me back, and I had met her before. And I said, you know, does it feel different now that Mike is back compared to what it was, you know, 2 months ago? And she said, oh, it's night and day. And I said, why? What's made the difference? And she said, well, when Mike is the leader, we know he loves us. And she said, it's amazing how that will compel you to work if you know the leader on the top loves you. Think institutionally, but act personally. There are two common temptations when you're dealing with public life, public responsibilities. One is the temptation to sort of divorce your personal faith from your public role. And so you can be a committed Christian, but you just don't talk about it. It has no relevance whatsoever. The other option is where you sort of shroud your whole workplace decisions in a religious penumbra where everything is sort of framed as a faith-informed perspective. And neither of these are actually the right way to go. Mike has done a very successful job as a very committed believer of helping to navigate those worlds. So he's lead director of Starbucks, CEO of JCPenney. He's also a committed Christian. How do you sort of navigate those waters in a very effective way? Well, there are a couple of different things that you can do. One is what in the book I describe as savvy grace. It is an intentional way of demonstrating, frankly, love and kindness in ways that are not off-putting to people who do not share our faith convictions. So this is not rocket science. It's not something that takes a lot of intellectual horsepower. However, it does take a great deal of intentionality. One of the things that can happen when you're a senior leader is you lose touch with lower levels of the organization. Very easy. I mean, even in a small organization like Gordon College, I experienced this, where we have about, 600 employees, and I can find that I'm sort of losing touch with some of the frontline folks who are there. You've got to have a regular way of engaging that. One of the things that I think is important about this savviness is that you have to realize that you cannot use the vernacular of the Christian community in the public landscape. That does not work. And sadly, too many of our fellow brothers and sisters miss that point. And they want to use the language of the church in the public arena, and it doesn't translate very well. So how is it that you demonstrate that sort of savvy kindness, that savvy grace? Well, a couple of things that I found over the course of the research. One is the importance of saying thank you. I learned from one of the people that I interviewed the importance of not just thanking my employees, but thanking their spouses. And so I've now put in practice where usually in March, I identify 30 employees who've been really exceptional performers. And instead of writing to them, I write to their spouses. Or if they're not married, I write directly to them and thank them for the sacrifices that they've made to make Gordon College thrive in the way that it has. Being able to pay attention to the wider framework, I cannot tell you how much of a difference that's made on sort of the culture change of our organization and the organization that I studied that was doing this. Second is that times of illness and death requires the leader's physical presence. You have to show up at the funeral. You have to make the hospital visit. Your physical presence makes a huge difference. It's amazing how much employees will remember you visiting. They won't remember what you said. They just remember that you showed up. And I found that this is a very intentional way that leaders of big organizations can make a significant difference. Now, if you have 40,000 employees, you can't go visit every single hospital. But you can be intentional about paying attention to folks when there is illness or death in their families. Very important. And then also, I found that this happened in corporate America a lot. The people who were committed Christ followers, one way that they brought their faith to bear was just simply saying, could I pray for you around a particular issue? And nobody says no. Nobody's going to turn away prayer. And that becomes a way in which you're able to sort of demonstrate your faith in a non-threatening way. Another thing that I found that's really important is that typically if there is one sort of personality trait I found among this 550 people is that they are maximizers by default. They are always trying to maximize as much as possible. They're trying to maximize their time. They're trying to maximize the capital they have. They're trying to maximize the relationships. They're trying to maximize the network. They're big maximizers. And they're always trying to push. And this is what's allowed them to get to the highest points of leadership because they've been able to do that. However, I think it's important if we're thinking about Christian framework and Christian thoughtfulness around leadership is that it's important that not just are we motivated by trying to maximize, but also to leave something behind. The biblical injunction about gleaning, I think, can be really instructive for us. This is the idea of where you don't harvest every single thing in the field, that you leave some behind for others to come by and pick up. It has a way of bestowing dignity to folks who don't have the same capability, but also has a way of empowering them in significant ways. It's interesting because One of the people that I interviewed and was thinking about this was a guy named Dennis Bakke. Dennis at one time was the CEO of AES, the world's largest privately held energy company. And Dennis wrote a wonderful book called Joy at Work. And in it, he outlined sort of his philosophy of how you help employees develop a joyful attitude about the work that they do. And one of his basic ideas, core principles that makes a lot of sense, is that you push decision-making down to as low a level as possible so that people can have ownership over part of their workplace. So he said, I don't make the decision what software my executive assistant needs to order or have on her desktop. I let her do that. I don't make the decision about what kind of inventory we need in this section. I let the people on the ground do that. The idea of gleaning is that you don't take all the responsibility. You also don't take all of the privileges and the resources and retain them at the upper level. Instead, you try to push them down. Fundamental, different way of understanding. Now, that rubs against the grain of maximizers because they don't want to leave anything behind. They don't want to leave anything on the table. But this actually becomes a vehicle in which it empowers so many people in the organization and also becomes a form of Christian witness. Another key thing that I learned about how is it that you think institutionally but act personally is you take a liberal arts approach to life. Now, it's interesting because other folks have written, there's a philosopher at Princeton who's written a book called on cosmopolitanism. It's this idea that you become a dilettante, that you sort of approach lots of different things. I actually found that the people who succeeded at the upper reaches of society, they had this intellectual curiosity and ability to do so many different things. Condoleezza Rice was a very impressive person I got a chance to interview. I don't know if you've had a chance to hear her. I know Beck had her on Whitworth's campus, just an incredibly impressive woman. But one of the things that impressed me the most about Condoleezza Rice is that up until age 15, she thought her life calling was to be a concert pianist. Very talented. She had cultivated that talent and was very accomplished. Everyone in her environment told her how talented she was and how great she was and that she was going to make a significant career of this. She went to a piano competition at age 15 and she said, I have been working on this particular piece for a year. And I was playing it and she said, I had it down really well. I felt very good about it. And she said, and then there was this other contestant who decided he was going to play that same piece. And he played it and did this masterful job. And she said, he was so much better than I could ever be. And she said, I had a wake-up call when I realized that he had decided to pick that piece about 2 weeks earlier. I had been working on it for a year, and he worked on it for 2 weeks. Now, it's interesting because all of the people that I interviewed, all 550 people can tell me stories about having a real moment of crisis in their life. And oftentimes it comes around a moment of crisis about their calling. They thought they were going in one direction and something changed. Jamie Dimon thought he was going to be the CEO of Citibank and he gets fired. You know, other leaders who think that this is what they're going to be doing and then the board doesn't choose them. Condoleezza Rice thought she was going to be a concert pianist, and at age 15, she realizes, you know what, I'm not going to be as good as I thought. I never will be that good. She demonstrated, though, what I found to be true among those folks who succeeded over the long haul. She had tremendous resilience. And actually, part of her resilience came from her faith. And she said, you know what, the Lord gave me these talents, but there must be something else he has in mind for me. So she went to the University of Denver as an undergraduate, age 16. While she was there, she took a class by a man named Professor Korbel. He was an expert on the Soviet Union, and he had such a passion for the Soviet Union, he got her excited about it, and she began to get interested in it. And he encouraged her in this. She ended up majoring in political science. He encouraged her to pursue doctoral work. She ended up doing that at the University of Notre Dame. She became a Soviet expert, and that really launched a whole different part of her career. The interesting thing is that Korbel is actually the father of Madeleine Albright. So he has been sort of the... Madeleine Albright says, I don't know how one man could inspire two women to be Secretary of State to have a very different view of the world. But lo and behold, that's what happened. Condoleezza Rice has this amazing ability to be interested in lots of different things. She can talk to you about the NFL till you're blue in the face. She knows all kinds of things about sports, music, current affairs, a liberal arts approach to life. It's one of the key things that I found that helps people sort of to be able to think institutionally, but even be able to act personally. Finding ways to develop these kinds of friendships that go across a whole spectrum of relationships makes a significant difference. I also found that one of the important things for folks who wanted to be successful over the long haul of bringing their faith to bear on their public life was they developed what, you know, in the Bible it refers to as a hearing heart, an ability to connect with other people and to genuinely hear what it is that they have to say. Probably one of the most interesting success stories in American aviation last 50 years is the rise of Southwest Airlines. Most people assume that sort of the real sort of driving success of Southwest Airlines is Herb Kelleher, who is this iconoclastic figure. And if you've ever heard Herb speak or been in his presence, you know he is a hard-charging guy. Drinks a lot, smokes a lot, curses a lot. He's a hard-charging kind of guy. Not the kind of personality you build an organization around. Iconoclasts are rarely the driving force of an organization. You have to have somebody who is a partner, who sort of helps soften the edges and actually builds the core of the organization. For Southwest Airlines, that's Colleen Barrett, a woman who is actually Herb Kelleher's secretary. She was his secretary. Herb was a lawyer, and he was actually the general counsel for what became what was the fledgling organization of Southwest Airlines. And they had to do some articles of reincorporation, and when they needed to do that, the board decided that they would put Herb as the CEO. Now, this was a very small operation. Well, the CEO cannot also be the legal secretary, so they didn't know what to do. So they made Colleen the legal secretary. She's a paralegal in San Antonio. In the process of that, Herb begins to sort of develop this great relationship with Colleen. And Colleen has this mothering sort of persona. She also smokes, she also drinks, sort of hard-charging kind of person, but she has this ability to really listen to other folks. She is the person who literally said, if we're going to build an organizational culture, I think love should be at the heart of it. And that is why their logo has a heart. And she is the person who said, we're not going to have an HR department, we're going to call it the people department, because we're about people, not rules and regulations. I went to do this interview with Colleen in Dallas, and she said, you know, I'm sorry, it's been hard to get in touch with me. I'm sort of in the process of moving, but not, haven't yet moved. And I said, oh, are you leaving Dallas? And she said, no, I'm just downscaling. I'm in this house, and I'm going to this other place. And I said, well, have you made the move? And she said, no, I'm sort of in process. I've been in process for a couple months, and I can't move for another 2 months. And I said, is it not yet finished? And she said, no, it's finished. I'm ready to go, but I can't move. And I said, well, you know, what's going on? And she said, well, I made this promise to somebody that we would have a wedding. They wanted to have their wedding in my backyard, and it's not happening until June, and so I need to wait until that happens. I said, oh, is a family member? And she said, no, it's not. I said, well, who is it? She said, well, actually, it's a flight attendant. And I said, well, okay, well, that makes sense. I said, you must have a really good rapport. She said, actually, I don't know her. I said, you don't know her? She said, no, she wrote to me when she got engaged because she heard I had a nice big backyard and she wondered could she have her wedding in my backyard. And I said, sure, of course, that's what we do at Southwest. And so she's willing to delay moving to a new house for 2 months until this wedding takes place. Nurturing a hearing heart. One of the key things that I think that we need to develop, frankly, in the church these days is a desire to have that hearing heart. I don't think we have that cultivated nearly enough. One of the things that I found is really important in the lives of leaders is the practice of some kind of quiet meditation. Having some kind of a regular routine that through both prayer and scripture reading, you can really develop that and help it to be part of your life. Here's one of the interesting things. So in my earlier work, Faith in the Halls of Power, I interviewed a lot of evangelical CEOs at both parachurch organizations and in secular organizations. And I found that for both sets of leaders, the first thing that goes when a leader gets into a busy period of life is daily devotional life. The first thing. It doesn't matter if you're leading a wonderful Christian ministry and you're extolling the virtues of quiet times. In our own lives, we just sort of let it slip away. And that's one of the sort of cautionary signals I want to just say to you, that is when I found people, I interviewed a number of people who ended up having real trauma in their professional life. About 10% of the people that I interviewed were involved in some scandal at some point in time. And some of them were in the midst of the scandal when I interviewed them. Some of them passed through it. Some of them it had been a number of years earlier. But then when I asked them to trace back, where were the problems? Where did they sort of begin to get off course? You know, getting off course never occurs in one big, giant mistake. It's never that. It's a series of small little steps that we make along the way. Importance of having regular time with the Lord helps us develop that hearing heart. Some of the challenging issues that require that ability to hear with the heart and to understand what's going on would be some of the sticky personnel situations. I asked people in the interview, what keeps you up at night? Number one answer, people issues, always. It's never about, do we expand? You know, how do we do this finance strategy? It's always about, well, I've got this employee, and I don't know if I should speak up now or if I should let it go. I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what the issue might be. Also, one of the key things that a leader has to do is discern among competing accounts of a situation. Steve Reinemann was the CEO of Pepsi, and he said, you know, every sermon that I hear about ethical dilemmas presents the issues as if they're black and white. And he said, it works nicely for a 25-minute sermon, but that's not life. He said, I never get issues that are black and white. What comes to my desk is always a very deep shade of gray. And I'm trying to discern among these different competing visions. Isn't that true? Right? You're trying to say, who's right here, and how is their perspective reflected, and is it possible they've gotten something off? Rarely is it something where this person's right and this person's wrong. It's always competing narratives and making the discerning process. And then the last sort of challenging issue that I found that involves that, really required to have that sort of sensitivity, is when does the leader insert herself? Really tough. How do you decide to sort of step into a particular situation and knowing what you're going to be able to do? Developing a hearing heart. I also found that the kind of work that we have to do when leading an enterprise, it's all-consuming. It's interesting. I was doing this research as a faculty member at Rice, where in the middle of that, I was approached by the search committee at Gordon to apply for the position, for the presidency there. And I actually flew to Boston to interview for the job, but also to do my own research interviews. And as it worked out, the day that I was interviewed for the job with the search committee, I interviewed with them in the morning, and then I was going to go and interview Diana Chapman Walsh, the president of Wellesley College, in the afternoon. And I didn't rent a car because driving in Boston is a nightmare, so I decided I was just going to take the T, and I was transferring stations when my cell phone rang. This is about 1:30 in the afternoon. And I answered the phone, and it was Price Harding, who was the search consultant who was involved in that search. And he said, Michael, you are the job. And I thought, what does that mean, you are the job? And it was a misconnection. He was saying, you got the job. But I have to say, I've learned, you are the job. And when you are the job, you really need to be able to cultivate a deep sense of prayer. So much of what happens here is where this job can sort of overtake your identity and you become conflated. And it becomes most obvious when you step away from the job. And that's when folks have real identity crises. You see this all the time. How do you cultivate the kind of character that will allow you to stand there? It's interesting because how our professional virtues can end up becoming real vices in our personal life, where you're so driven and organized that you try to manage your kids' lives in the same way you try to manage your business. Or where you think you can always talk your way through a situation and you try and apply that skill set in your relationship with your spouse. It becomes very difficult. Off of the Oval Office, there's a very small little private office that presidents over the last 100 years have used for their private study. There's no executive assistant in that room. It's a little area just off of the Oval Office where the president can go in and read or do whatever they might want to do. It becomes sort of a little bit of a retreat because the Oval Office is actually a very public office. Lots of people in and through there, and there's not really sort of a sense of sort of being removed. When Jimmy Carter was president, he said that little office became sort of his prayer room. And he said, I found that I really could not make it through the day if I did not spend some time praying in that particular place. And he said, I have never prayed as much before or since as I did the 4 years when I was in the White House. Now, I don't know what you think about Jimmy Carter's politics or what he did as president, but I have to say, I'm actually encouraged that we had a president who was praying as much as he was. I would love for all of our presidents to do that. Having a sense of sort of taking the burdens of the particular office and making that part of a daily life and regular rhythm of prayer, I found is really important because in one way or another, you are the job. I also found that probably the most potent form of Christian witness that you can have is through sacrifice, by giving things up. That you get a sense of moral authority not by what you do or accomplish, but what you're willing to sort of yield. I have to say, I was just so impressed with Jim Daly. I was sitting there. I've known Jim for a number of years. I never knew that he had given up that sort of heated parking space. And I got to tell you, I'm really glad he told us that, because it sort of just him saying that caused me to think, what perk do I have that maybe I should give to the housekeeper or to the administrative assistant? So much of the moral authority we have is we garner it, but what we're willing to give up when other folks think it's your due, it's what you deserve to get. This is David Grizzle. You may not know his name or his face, but he's actually changed your life. David Grizzle has most recently been at the FAA as the chief operating officer, but in the late 1990s, he was the senior vice president of Continental Airlines. At that time, David had this crazy idea that Continental, which was maybe number four or five among national airlines, ought to somehow build a partnership with one of its competitors, Northwest Airlines, where they would sell seats on each other's planes. They would recognize reciprocal benefits for their frequent flyers. It'd be a way in which they could sort of do things together, sort of code share, sometimes on routes where they might be able to build some kind of joint alliance. This actually laid the groundwork for all the consolidation that we've seen in the airline industry of the last 10 years. It started with this man and this particular work. And it was wildly successful. Wall Street responded very positively. Continental's stock went through the roof. And as a result, David was entitled to a very large end-of-year bonus. David, however, is a committed Christ follower, and he and his wife, Anne, have always tried to live relatively simple lives. They don't buy new cars. He always sort of has a used car, doesn't have a big house. He lived in a condo townhouse in Houston for a number of years. And their idea was they would love to be able to take this money and, frankly, give it to World Vision. That was a ministry they were passionate about and wanted to be able to help further some of the work. But he said, you know, if that money comes to me, it's going to be taxed, and that's less money to go to the charity. And I wondered if there might be something that we could do that would be countercultural. So David then approaches the general counsel at Continental and said, would it be possible for me to give back my bonus to the company and have those dollars channeled to the corporate philanthropy, and then I could direct the organization that received the funding. This would allow me to sort of accomplish my goal of wanting to get this money to this charity. It would also sort of allow for more of that to go. I'm wondering, is that, you know, possible? Well, the attorney had to check the law books because he never had an executive want to give back their bonus. But sure enough, there was a way in which they could make that happen. But here's the interesting thing. That was just part one of the story. You see, David was the person who had negotiated this great deal that had caused the stock price to go through the roof. And because of that, he was entitled to a big bonus that year. But so were the other top executives of Continental Airlines. And so David then went around and knocked on the door of each of those executives who was going to get a bonus that year. And he said, you know, Mark, you don't need that $1 million. Why don't you join me and give that money back, channel it through the corporate philanthropy? You'll look good, the company will look good, and we'll do a lot of good. And because everybody realized David was the reason that they were doing so well that year, he had garnered the moral authority that when he was willing to give it up himself, it had a way of compelling them to do the same. That year, the top seven executives of Continental Airlines gave away $8 million of their end-of-year bonus. And it became probably the most profound form of Christian witness David Grizzle ever had in his corporate career, because he was able to talk about how, out of Christian conviction, he cared about poor kids around the world. Great leaders sacrifice, and that becomes one of the ways in which we bear witness to our faith. One of the key things that I found over the course of this particular study is that nothing has the ability to engender the kind of trust that we want within our organizations, like cultivating, frankly, the Christian virtue of love. How that gets carried out looks different in different places, but can end up making a significant difference. I told you the story that Mike Ullman was the leader who I interviewed, who really impressed me the most, had done an amazing job. Here's the interesting thing about Mike. Mike has a rare degenerative spinal condition that makes it painful for him to walk. He's had three very intensive surgeries that have affected sort of his organs. And if Mike were here in this room and he were trying to make it from that table to the podium, he would have to ride his Segway. He really can't make that long distance of a walk. When he was named the CEO of JCPenney, he said he was there. They brought him in. They were having an associates meeting, and he was going to be announced. And it wasn't scripted or planned. It sort of came at the last possible minute. And so there was a large group of about 800 associates who were there, and there was a stage like here. And he realized that he was going to be introduced. The problem is that Mike realized that there were three steps to get up on the stage, but there was no rail. And so he said, I'm sitting there in this whole meeting realizing they're about to call me up on that stage and I don't know how to get up there. He said, I was humiliated. I thought, you know, they're not going to see me as a great leader. I can't even walk. Began to have all this sort of self-doubt, wondering, you know, God, why have you put me here? This is a company that's really struggling. I'm not sure I can solve these problems. I don't even know what to do. And so he said, I did what came naturally. I prayed and said, God, I really don't know what to do in this situation. I need you to help me. After a couple minutes, he got an idea that I think is probably divine providence guiding him. They called, the person introduced him from the stage, and before he got up, he stood up at his chair, and he said, before I go up there, I want to try a trust experiment. I want to ask you if you would all please bow your heads and close your eyes, and don't open them until I tell you. And he said, I looked around, and people pretty much did what I was asking them to do. So he said, I stumbled my way over to the beginning of the steps, and then I got down, and I crawled up on the stage. I came around to the platform, and had to literally pull myself up. And once he was in position, he said, "Okay, you can open your eyes." He said, "The reason why we're going to be able to work well together is because I trust you. You've won my trust because you've demonstrated that you're willing to try and do the honorable thing. The reason I needed you to be able to close your eyes is because I couldn't walk up on this platform, and I didn't want to be introduced to you from crawling up the stage. You see, I have a handicap, a challenge in my life. Mine is visible, but probably all of us have one thing or another in our life that makes it difficult. The reason we're going to succeed, fellow associates, is if we're willing to trust one another. And that starts with a commitment to love one another." Now, there aren't a whole lot of Fortune 500 CEOs who begin their leadership by talking about love, but it has a real lasting effect. How do you demonstrate Christian faithfulness in the midst of significant public leadership? You do it through love. Thank you very much.